This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Gloria Steinem, has been a leader and symbol of the women's movement since the 1970s and continues to speak out at the age of 81. She co-founded Ms. Magazine in 1972 and remained one of its editors for 15 years. She's written about political, social, and economic barriers to women's rights. And she's also written about her own life and the personal obstacles she's had to overcome, and how they represent obstacles many women face. Her new memoir is called My Life on the Road. She estimates she spent at least half of her time on the road for more than four decades. She's traveled with a purpose, to raise awareness of women's issues and organize women in the U.S. and around the world. As we'll hear, she kind of grew up on the road. She spoke with Terry last Monday.
Gloria Steinem, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to start by reading the dedication of your new book.
This book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India. Knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate, he said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life." Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you.
Thank you for reading that dedication to your new book. When did you first speak about your abortion?
The amazing thing was that it took me so long. There was no women's movement. It was supposed to be a secret. Women didn't share in the same way. So it wasn't until many years later, after New York Magazine had started, and I had gone to cover an abortion speak out held in a church downtown in New York City. And suddenly I heard other women standing up and talking about what it was like to have to go out and seek an illegal abortion. This was before the Supreme Court ruling. So I sat there as a reporter for New York Magazine, listening to women tell their stories, you know, that were tragic and ludicrous and every human emotion all wrapped into one. And suddenly I thought, wait a minute, you know, I had an abortion, and actually one in three American women had needed an abortion at some time in her life. So why is this illegal and why is it dangerous? And it's the kind of revelation that comes from people just telling the truth and discovering you're not alone.
So is this book, this dedication, the first time you mentioned the doctor's name who performed your illegal abortion in England?
It is the first time I mentioned his name.
And why did you decide it was okay now to mention his name?
Well, first of all, he was quite old at the time, so he clearly could no longer be alive, no matter what. Secondly, the laws have changed. Our understanding has changed. It just seemed to me that it was time to say thank you.
Do you often wonder what your life would have been like had you not had the abortion and had you had a child at that age?
You know, I don't know what would have happened. I had been doing all the foolish things that we then did, like riding horseback, throwing ourselves downstairs, you know, all kinds of things in the hope.
Let me stop you right there. Did you throw yourself downstairs?
Yeah, kind of. I did. And I am the most cowardly person you can imagine, so physically speaking, but I did. I kept thinking that somehow, you know, I could, I don't know what I thought. I was desperate. I really was desperate because, you know, I just knew that if I went home and married, which I would have had to do, it would be to the wrong person. It would be to a life that wasn't mine at all.
You spent half of your life on the road. You're still on the road a lot. You grew up on the road. Let's talk a little bit about your very atypical childhood. Your mother was often incapacitated by depression. Can we call it depression?
You know, I don't know what to call it. I think her spirit was broken. You know, she, before I was born, had to give up everything she loved and cared about. And she was depressed. She got addicted to tranquilizers. You know, I don't think there was any... When I first wrote about her years ago, I was surprised that people would say to me, do you fear this was hereditary? And I was shocked. And I always said, only if patriarchy is hereditary. You know, because I just think her spirit was broken.
Your father, until you were 10, during the summer, ran a dance pavilion that he created. Would you describe what your father did summers?
This was a little lake in southern Michigan called Clark Lake. He had built a kind of long, big pier with part of it covered, part of it uncovered over the lake. And on weekdays, there would be sort of canned music and a jukebox, and on weekends, a band. Then the big bands of the 30s and 40s used to travel the country in the summertime in a bus. And so we would get some famous bands sometimes, Wayne King and Joe Venuti. I mean, names I don't know if people know anymore. And this was his dream. And he, you know, he created a kind of magical place.
So what was it about being there or about being with your father that broke your mother's spirit?
It just wasn't hers. Well, let me describe what she had been doing before, long before I was born. She was a pioneer newspaper reporter and journalist and actually editor, which was extraordinary. But it was an era in which she at first had to write under a man's name in order to get published. So, you know, she was a real pioneer, and she loved it. She adored it. At the same time, she was married to my father, a wonderful, kind, charming, utterly irresponsible man. So there were always money troubles and, you know, lots of difficulties. She had my sister, who was 9 years older than me. And I think, you know, as she later explained, she'd fallen in love with a man at work and had grown up believing that you could not divorce, you could not change. She had a girlfriend who wanted to come to New York with her, where she could try her hand at being a journalist. You know, she had all these aspirations. She just couldn't make it work. She had a what was then called a nervous breakdown, which meant she was in a sanatorium for a year or two, I'm not sure. And there she got hooked on an early form of tranquilizer.
So getting back to this life that you had as a child, your mother's spirit was broken. It was often hard for her to get out of bed. Your father created this, you know, like wonderful dance pavilion summers. But then when the summer was over, the family would move into a van and drive south and basically live, when I say a van, I should say trailer, I suppose. And then the family would live in the trailer for the duration until the following summer. You write that you never started out with enough money to complete the trip. Your father would buy antiques and then sell them to antique dealers, you know, buy them at country auctions and then sell them to antique dealers at higher prices to fund your trip south. How did you like being itinerant like that?
I suppose there are two things happen at once when you're a child. One is that you just accept as normal whatever is around you. And the other is that you go to the movies and you see kids or your classmates, because I would go to school till it got cold, to Halloween or something, who are living a different way, and you want to be like them. You want to be like the other kids. It never for a moment occurred to me that they might envy me. So I both accepted it and hoped that my real parents would come find me and take me to a house with a picket fence and a pony. I mean, that's the degree of realism and fantasy.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't in school for those years that your family was on the road. How did you learn to read and do basic math?
Well, I'm not sure I've ever learned to do basic math, to be frank. But I learned to read just because my family had lots and lots of books. especially my mother, you know, read all the time. My memory is that I learned how to read from ketchup bottles and labels and billboards along the highway. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I don't remember not knowing how to read.
You've said in the past, and you said on our show years ago, that you're a foodaholic, addicted to food. You said, I'm a fat woman who's not fat at the moment.
True.
And I think I didn't understand at the time that your father was 300 pounds. What was his relationship to food?
Food was his drug of choice and joy. You know, he knew every all-you-can-eat roadside restaurant within, you know, 100 miles of wherever we were. He knew who had the best super-thick malteds. He was a foodie without snobbery, I would say.
How did that affect your relationship to food? And I'm wondering if your father, when he binged, wanted you to eat a lot too, so that he could maybe think of it as he was doing it for you, to make you happy.
I don't know if he thought that, but he did think that ice cream was the ultimate reward. I mean, no matter what bad thing happened, say our car had been repossessed by the finance company, or he had mortgaged the house without my mother's knowing about it, and you know, no matter what bad thing happened, or no matter what bad thing had happened to me, you know, a childhood kind of a bad thing. He thought that a malted in a movie could cure everything. And I have to say he wasn't wrong. A malted in a movie can go a very long way.
So how did that affect your sense of yourself as a foodaholic?
I'm still a sugar junkie. I still find it very difficult. I can't keep certain kinds of food in the house, because they talk to me, you know, especially when I'm sitting there writing. So
they call you over.
They summon me. I think they summon me, and I think writers also need to chew in some odd way. Well, so I cannot keep ice cream or bread or, you know, anything too rewarding in the house.
I remember you telling me that one of the reasons why you co-founded Ms. Magazine was that writing for other magazines, they just weren't interested in women's issues. They'd say, oh, we did an article about women's issues or about the women's liberation movement like 8 months ago, so we don't need another article yet. And that article about men was like articles about the world, but articles about women fell into the category of like, yeah, we covered that a while ago. We're done.
Yeah, well, that was true of women's magazines, but in other places where I was writing, including the Sunday New York Times, you know, lots of other places, the attitude was even worse. It was sort of, well, if we publish an article saying women are equal, then in order to be objective, we'll have to publish one saying they're not, you know. So
what was your reaction to that?
Well, it seemed perfectly logical to them because they thought it was debatable. Mm-hmm. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, I definitely
you mean. Yeah, right, but it seemed extremely frustrating and outrageous to me.
Do you remember the articles, the headlines in the first edition of Ms? I want to see if those articles could still be written today. Like, how much have things changed?
Well, we did have a piece about a couple that had made a marriage contract in order to make up for the unequal laws on the books. They had made their own contract. We had reprinted a article from another feminist publication called Why I Want a Wife by Judy Cyphers. I remember she deserves credit.
I remember
credit,
that S-Y-F-E, article.
Right? and it was a woman talking about all the reasons why she needed a wife. It was funny and wonderful.
To have somebody at home who was doing the cooking and cleaning and taking care of the errands and stuff,
which was
wives were supposed to do. But she was working, so she needed somebody to take on that role.
Exactly.
Would have been helpful.
Right.
Yeah. What else was in there?
There was an article by, let's see, I'm trying to remember. It was a woman, an activist in the National Welfare Rights Organization, and she was explaining, I think it was Johnny Tillman, who was explaining why welfare was a woman's issue. At the time, it was viewed more as a racial or poverty issue, but not a women's issue, even though almost everybody on welfare was female. It just wasn't perceived as it should be. And so she was writing about what life was like and why it was a women's issue.
If I asked you to make a list of the five most important issues for women today, what would be on that list?
Well, I can do it, but I would like to say that the most important issues are those to the women who are listening. I mean, it's not about dictating to each other what's important, but supporting each other in solving the ones that are in our daily lives.
I like
however,
point that you just made.
if you add up, you know, in terms of the numbers of people, I would say that competing for number one would be violence against females worldwide. If you add up all the forms of violence, whether it's domestic violence in this country, which is at an enormously high rate, I mean, the most dangerous place for a woman in this country is her own home, and she's most likely to be beaten or killed by a man she knows. Or it is FGM, female genital mutilation, or it is female infanticide, or honor killings, or child marriage, and too early childbirth, which is a major cause of death among adolescent girls worldwide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, violence has reached an emergency. Well, any violence is an emergency, but,
collectively. Well, the sense of emergency has certainly increased with groups like the Taliban and ISIS truly attacking women and denying them any form of rights.
Yes. No, it's the extreme forms of patriarchy, often religious, so-called religious, and the violence against females in war zones, sexualized violence in the Congo and, you know, many in the former Yugoslavia, you know, and all of these have mounted up to a real emergency. But tied, I would say, for first place is the ability of women to decide when and whether to have children, because that is a major cause of death. The lack of that ability is a major cause of death. And it is also a major cause of inability to be educated or to be free outside the home or to be healthy. You know, so I would say those two concerns, violence, sexualized violence against women, and reproductive freedom or reproductive justice are right up there in our focus in every country.
I interviewed you several times on Fresh Air in the past, and I want to play an excerpt of our interview from 1992. So this was 23 years ago?
Oh, that's shocking.
Right? And one of the things you talked about was you were looking back on having had a lumpectomy, breast cancer, and how that affected you. So I want to play what you said about that. So again, this is from 1992, Gloria Steinem, looking back on having that lumpectomy and how it affected her life.
It made me realize several things. One was, this may sound strange if I try to say it short, but that actually, I was less afraid of dying than of aging, or not of aging exactly. I didn't know how to enter the last third of life because there were so few role models. Because when I first heard this diagnosis, first I thought, ironically, oh, so that's how it's going to end, you know. And then I thought to myself, as if it was welling up from the deepest part of me, I've had a wonderful life. And I treasure that moment, you know, it meant a lot to me. But on the other hand, it also made me realize that in this culture, women, we know how to be in the central plateau of life. And I'd been there a terrifically long time because I'd become a grown-up too early because my mother being an invalid. So from about 10 to 52 or so, I'd been in this central plateau. Now I was entering a whole new place. It was like falling off a cliff because I couldn't see enough people ahead of me. You know, in the last two or three years of really, how shall I say, of kind of paying more attention to my own inner life, I've realized that this aging in the last third of life or whatever is a new country. I now actually feel excited about it because you, as Carolyn Heilbrun has pointed out so brilliantly in Writing a Woman's Life, women become ourselves after 50. You know, we leave behind this female impersonator role and drop a lot of baggage and really become much more our true selves.
You know what I find particularly interesting about hearing you thinking about the latter part of your life is that I think for a lot of women, it's the end of your life where you're supposed to be punished for the freedoms that you've taken during the first parts of your life. You know, like if you've decided to be independent or, you know, not be married or not have children or something, you're punished for that in the end because you're supposed to look forward to an old age where you're lonely, you're alone, there's no one to be with, no one to take care of you. I mean, I think that's been really instilled in all of
mm-hmm,
us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's sort of the secular version of hell, I think. and like the religious version of hell, it has nothing to do with real life.
Okay, that was Gloria Steinem on Fresh Air in 1992, and I just did the math, and I think you were 58 when that was recorded. Now,
thank you. Thank you for playing that because it's fascinating to listen to your earlier self.
Yeah, so does what you said then still ring true?
Yes, it does. And I realize that I realize more now that I'm past that stage, that 50 was a very difficult birthday because it was the end of the central years of life. But 60, which I was just entering when I was speaking then, was like entering, as I was saying, a new country. And that means that all the demands of gender that spread from something like 12 to something like 50 and are something of a prison sometimes are gone and suddenly you're free. Here's my comparison now. Remember when you were 9 or 10 and you were this independent little girl climbing trees and saying, I know what I want, I know what I think, and so on. That was before gender descended for most of us, as Carol Gilligan has pointed out in her work. After 50, you've theoretically, according to society, had kids, raised them, so your gender role is over. And ironically, I found by 60, you're free again. So you're the same person you were at 9 or 10, only now you have your own apartment, you can reach the light switch, you know, you hopefully have a little money so that you can, you know, do what you want. There is, as I was saying then, a whole different country after 60.
Gloria Steinem, it has been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Gloria Steinem spoke with Terry last Monday. Steinem's new memoir is called My Life on the Road. In this season of witches, a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stacy Schiff re-examines the most famous witches' tale of them all. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of The Witches.
It's our national campfire story. The Salem witch hunts, of course, specifically the 9 months in 1692 when the town of Salem and surrounding areas spiked into a code red terror alert mode. By the time the Salem villagers came to their senses or grew exhausted or expelled the witches, take your pick of interpretations, 19 people, women and men, had been hanged. In addition, one stubborn old man, a suspected wizard who refused to participate in his own trial, was pressed to death with heavy stones, while several more accused witches died in prison, and two demonic dogs were executed. Almost immediately after the witch hunts happened, Salem did its best to forget them. No official records of any of the sessions of the witchcraft court survive. Salem diaries of the time are mum on the months of mid-1692. But no matter how deep Salem tried to bury the story, generations of scholars, writers, and thrill seekers keep scrabbling at it. Think only of all those high school productions of Arthur Miller's The Crucible that get mounted every year. Now along comes Stacy Schiff, exhuming the witch hunts once again in her eerie and engrossing new book, The Witches. Schiff and Salem are well met, As a popular historical writer, Schiff is a proven spellbinder. She seems to have digested all the available contemporary writings about the witch hunts, as well as more recent scholarship. Unlike, say, historian Mary Beth Norton's superb 2002 book, In the Devil's Snare, built on her crucial insight that many of the alleged victims of witchcraft were also traumatized survivors of the Indian wars that ravaged the area, The Witches isn't fueled by one central hunch. Instead, Schiff, like a broomstick jockey flying through the night sky, surveys the whole panoramic expanse of Salem, the ministers and the odd women easily targeted as witches, the intransigent judges and the tavern owners and jail keeps who made a killing on the phenomenon of the witch trials. As you might expect from a writer whose last book focused on that mistress of intrigue, Cleopatra, Schiff lingers longest over the bewitched accusers, most of them teenaged girls, the most vocal of whom were servants. Schiff suggests that these girls, who ordinarily wouldn't have captured the ear of powerful men, expressed in fits what they could not communicate in words. She spells out what's often left implicit about Salem, that it's one of the few episodes in American history when women, particularly young women, play the central role. Schiff herself is most commanding when she conjures up her storyteller's art to evoke the world of Salem and particularly the bitter winter of 1692 in that paranoid village perched on the edge of a fairy tale dark wilderness. When the accused witch and Indian slave Tituba electrified the court with her testimony of a devil accompanied by a yellow bird, red cats, and flying knives, it was the dreariest season of the year. Accusers and accused, with their lurid tales of witch cakes, poppets, magical green ointments, and other wonders of the invisible world, supplied color and distraction from the endless Puritan round of work. By summertime, as the storm of accusations exhausted itself, Schiff says that everyone in the area now knew an accused witch. In the free-for-all, men accused women, girls their elders, children their mothers. The accused ranged in age from 7 to 80. And Schiff does her best, despite the scarcity of contemporary accounts, to bring the personalities of the accused, and particularly the condemned, to vivid life again. In the haunting opening of The Witches, Schiff announces her intention to moodily summon up rather than to solve the mystery of Salem. She says, "Salem represents one of the rare moments in our enlightened past when the candles are knocked out and everyone seems to be groping about in the dark, the place where all good stories begin." Indeed they do. In The Witches, Schiff may not lead us out of the dark, but she makes it an inviting place to linger a while and listen to fresh details of a familiar story all over again.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Witches by Stacey Schiff. Coming up, Carrie Brownstein of Portlandia and the band Slater Kinney. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people were singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality, and I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah. Dream of the 90s is alive, Portland.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Carrie Brownstein, co-founded the band Slater Kinney in 1994 and is the co-creator and co-star with Fred Armisen of the IFC TV comedy series Portlandia. In her new memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, Brownstein tries to reconcile the uncertain, anxious person she often was offstage with a defiant kinetic guitarist and singer she was on stage. Her band, a trio of women, was considered part of the riot girl music scene of women performers, who defied or commented on female stereotypes and played powerful music. Brownstein says she sometimes found that label limiting. A theme in Brownstein's new memoir is her search for identity, after growing up with parents who had identity issues of their own. Her mother was anorexic. Her father came out as gay in his mid-50s. Brownstein's memoir also is about life in a band and the ways in which her band did and did not become family.
Carrie Brownstein, welcome back to Fresh Air. You bought your first guitar at a suburban instrument store. You're right, it's the kind of store you go to with your parents that smelled of antiseptic, where everything was shiny and glistening with newness, where other parents are renting saxophones or clarinets for their kid to play in the school jazz band. Did it bother you at the time that your guitar had such a suburban pedigree?
Well, I suppose, although, you know, when you grow up in the suburbs, I mean, yes, you sort of look at the city like this sort of urbane, like, sibling that you only sort of know, like maybe like a step sibling that's like a little bit cooler than you and somehow escaped. But I saw the guitar as my way out of the suburbs. So it was sort of an aspirational purchase. But yes, there's always a little bit of embarrassment, I think, when you know that everything cooler and hipper seems to be happening, you know, in some center that you're not really a part of yet.
And when you started performing, did you want to, like, erase your suburban background and end up erasing part of yourself?
I don't know if I wanted to erase my suburban background. I think more so as a teenager, you know, one tends to be sort of derisive of that kind of locale, where later you realize, you know, the ways it's informed you, and it gives you kind of a point of view that can be interesting, or at least, you know, you're more willing to embrace it for sort of the weirdness that the suburbs can sometimes possess. But I think I definitely was engaged in a lot of self-effacement or desire for erasure as a teenager as just a means of escape or of trying to kind of make myself into something that I could be more comfortable with, because I was very awkward.
Yeah, well, you say that at night you'd often wake up terrified of death or disease and that your brain rarely quieted. What were those fears that haunted you in the middle of the night or during the day, for that matter?
Well, I was growing up in a fairly unstable household with a mother whose encroaching illness was very much permeating the landscape of my psyche and also of the family. And so these fears were somewhat amorphous, but I just had a kind of general anxiety and sense of unease. So I would wake up scared of a fire, that all my hair was falling out, and I would actually go down the hall and sleep on the floor of my parents' room, or go and try to sneak into my sister's room, where she would usually kick me out. I think later I was just trying to tether myself. I wanted to kind of form a closeness with this family that I could sense was kind of dissipating.
You mentioned your mother's encroaching illness. Your mother was anorexic, and when you were 14, she checked herself into a clinic. You write that her hair had become thin and brittle and had been falling out. Her eyes and cheeks were hollow. She was somewhere between rotting and a fossil. When did you realize she had an eating disorder? Did you know that before she acknowledged it?
Yes, I did. Although there's a passage in the book where I hear the term anorexia for the first time and describe it. It's like a prize I'd won sort of in a drawing that I didn't even know I entered. I was so relieved to realize that there was a term for this, which I witnessed every day, every, you know, meals and eating and that sort of ritual of gathering at a table is such a part of childhood. And that was such a strange moment. It made me nervous to watch my mom cook for us and then not engage in the act of eating with us. And it was so, it was almost like a performance to witness the ways she would avoid eating food.
you didn't know it at the time, but your father was gay. He didn't come out until he was 55, and you were probably in your 20s by then. You say you were thankful that he was happy, and you say now there's someone to know. Did you feel like there was no one present when you were growing up, that your father was, that he didn't know who he was, therefore you didn't know who he was?
Definitely. My dad, as I describe in the book, that he was sort of this series of signifiers, a generic office building in the suburbs, a three-piece suit, a soccer coach, a clean-cut, you know, haircut and clean-shaven, and he interacted with my sister and I through activities and much less so with emotions, and he really only ever had one story from his childhood. There was just this blankness that was very difficult to penetrate. I always felt very close to him, but by default. And I really just didn't know him. I think none of us did. So yeah, when he came out, it was like this moment where something goes from black and white into color. There was just this brightening, this sense of illumination. And within that gleaming came feeling. It just seeped into him and into all of his relationships.
So growing up in the house that you did, with a father who didn't acknowledge to other people or maybe even to himself he was gay, and a mother who was anorexic, I could see how music would be an especially nice place to live away from that.
Yes. First and foremost, it provided a sense of community. And I think when people grow up with a family characterized by chaos and uncertainty and fragility, you know, you look for substitution for that. And music was a means through which I could meet people and begin the process of exploring who I was or who I could be, trying on roles that just allowed a means of escape or expression that I really hadn't been able to possess or, you know, aim for. And it was very freeing. It took a while, you know, but just even listening to music with a group of people and going to shows, you know, that really was a pathway towards getting out of some of that darkness.
The first song you wrote lyrics for was called You Annoy Me. Can you sing or recite your words to it?
Well, first of all, I should let you know that the first song I wrote technically was Buffy is Fluffy about our dog, which I don't go into in the book. When people are saying, wow, what a revealing book. Nope, not true. Didn't even mention Buffy is Fluffy in the book.
are you saying you'd really prefer to recite the lyrics to Buffy is Fluffy?
Well, those are the lyrics, Terry.
Oh, those
so
are the lyrics. That's it. That's a short.
You got a twofer there. Here's You Annoy Me. I will not sing it.
Okay.
But I think the gist of the lyrics are, the way you look really annoys me. The way you talk really bores me. You think that you are always right. You keep me awake at night. Don't bother me. Don't talk to me. Don't talk to me. That's a verse and a chorus. And through the use of repetition, I'm really driving the point home. and I should add that that song I wrote as a teenager, not yesterday. So just be forgiving.
Were you dedicating that mentally to someone in particular?
I don't think so. I mean, that seems like a very typical teenage angst, mm-hmm. Recitation. The whole world was kind of driving me crazy at that point, as it's apt to do when you're young. Although sometimes I think that even with more sophisticated and nuanced songwriting in Slater-Kinney, that I was essentially kind of going over the same theme, just in a in a slightly different way.
Well, you founded Slater-Kinney with Corin Tucker. And then eventually Janet Weiss joined as the drummer. I want to play a track called Dig Me Out, which is built, as you say in your book, which is built around your guitar riff. And I think, you know, you mentioned fearlessness. I think the guitar sound that you developed has a very fearless sound to it and a very aggressive sound. Do you want to describe what you felt at the time you were striving for, the kind of sound and meaning that you wanted as a guitarist?
Well, I'm a self-taught musician, and I write in the book about how Corin and I sort of learned to play guitar in relation to each other. And I wanted the guitar to feel weaponized. I wanted it to be analogous to a voice that I didn't yet have and may never have, which is to harness volume and a sense of the caustic and power and to interweave that with melody so that it's something people can latch onto or be carried away by. And I wanted it to be trenchant, also a little scary. I guess that's the sound I was going for. I don't usually have to describe it, but that's my attempt too.
Well, let's hear Dig Me Out. And this is Slater Kinney. It's your third album, right? And also Dig Me Out is the first thing that Carrie Brownstein had tattooed. And if you see her book, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, you will see a picture of that tattoo. So one of the joys having the actual book.
That's a real selling point. So salacious. Guess where that tattoo is. You won't know until you read the book.
Okay. So here's Dig Me Out. So that's Dig Me Out. That's Slater Kinney, and my guest, Carrie Brownstein, co-founded Slater Kinney and co-created and stars in the TV series Portlandia. Now she has a new memoir called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. So in your memoir, you write about how, I think you were in your 20s, and Slater Kinney was starting to be written about in major music magazines, and one of the early articles about you outed you as having formerly dated Corin Tucker, your co-founder of the band. And you must have been pretty angry. I mean, that you weren't out about it to your family or to some other people, and you didn't talk about this with whoever was writing the article. I'm wondering, was it fact-checked? Do you know, did they call you and say, is that true, before printing it?
It wasn't fact-checked through me or Corin, and I don't know if someone corroborated that outside of the two of us, but it was a surprise to me when it was published, as well as a surprise to my family.
Just as an example of the larger impact of being outed, what was the impact on your life?
It's hard for me to not think about it in today's terms and just be relieved that essentially it was a conversation between me and my family, or just put me in dialogue with myself, that there wasn't the chorus of opinions on social media that I had to reconcile with. So in some ways, I feel very grateful for that. But it was very disorienting at the time.
I think about, you know, Portlandia, the comedy series you do with Fred Armisen on IFC.
Which people are probably like, what? This is the same person that does Portlandia?
No,
this is
exactly.
Such a serious interview.
No, but that's the thing. Like, the sensibility in Portlandia, it's a comedy. It mocks, like, political correctness and people who are very, very righteous in their diets or their clothing or, you know, whatever. And it's so different from the kind of, like, fearlessness and power and caustic energy that you wanted to project on stage as a guitarist. And I'm trying to bridge that gap. I guess, like, is that two different sides of you? Is it just, like, getting older and having your sensibility naturally change a little bit, though you're still playing music with Slater Kinney?
I mean, I think that sensibility was always there, and the ability to observe and to see contradictions and to see hypocrisy and within myself, but also in the people and situations around me. I feel like Portlandia is so much in the subtext of this book in particular. So many of the early situations in these, you know, punk and indie rock communities, which espouse inclusiveness but feel very elite and exclusive and possess very labyrinthine rules that are hard to follow and that you feel terrible for messing up in. You know, I think a lot of that ends up in Portlandia. So, yeah, it doesn't feel like a separate part of myself. It feels like another means of communicating ideas within a very different vernacular and with a little more levity. And I like absurdity. So many things feel and are best characterized by absurdity, best explained by absurdity, that I like the way Portlandia allows for that. You know, it's a conversation in the same way Slater Kinney is. It's just elicits very different emotions, I think, I assume.
So I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on, Terry.
Carrie Brownstein spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Brownstein's new memoir is called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farragut. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuri. Oh, and by the way, did we mention we really like Chicago? And not just for the hot dogs and pizza. No reason, just throwing that out there.